I was talking to someone recently, a middle-aged friend, reasonably put together on the outside, and I asked if there was anything that he was looking forward to. You know, I was just making conversation. And he kind of paused and said, "Man, I'm just trying to make it through the week." And, you know, I didn't think much of it at the time, because I get it. I've been there. But something about that response did stay with me, because I guess I've been noticing that kind of response a lot more often these days. You know, whether it's online or in real life, wherever. And it's this, I guess you could say it's this response that has an absence of any forward-looking energy in people, right? So it's not quite depression. I wouldn't call it complete hopelessness in the clinical sense. I guess there's just this deflated feeling around the future. Like the future's still there, technically. It's just that nobody's particularly excited to meet it anymore. So I started paying closer attention to the kind of language people use now. Like the casual usage of "we're cooked," right? You know, you'll see that kind of language being used in social media all the time. Usually it's about AI or healthcare or the Epstein class or climate. I mean, pretty much anything structural. And usually it's, of course, said with kind of a sarcastic laugh, right? Usually. But underneath the laugh, there is something that it's not really a joke, you know? And I think, I would say by and large, at some point people just stopped believing that the future is going to be better. Or even that there is one, for that matter, right? And I don't necessarily mean this in a dramatic civilizational collapse kind of a way. I just mean this in just the everyday way that where you sort of unconsciously stop making any long-term plans with any real conviction. And you're not quite sure when that started. I think this is because planning for the future, it started to feel like a formality that you perform rather than something that you actually believe in. I mean, the future, you know, it used to be something people hope for, right? But now it's feeling more like something that you just manage, or something that you're bracing for and I guess trying to be ready for in some way without even knowing what you're supposed to be ready for. And I think this is exhausting for people because, it's exhausting in a way that's hard to put your finger on, or to locate, or just really, it's hard to describe this accurately. Okay, so there is this version of the future that, you know, it used to exist in the cultural imagination that I don't really think exists anymore in the same way. And I'm not talking about the jetpack version here, right? I'm talking about something more ordinary than that. The assumption that, well, and it was an assumption, mostly unexamined, that things would get, or no, things would, I guess, let's say broadly improve. And that your kids would probably have it a little better than you did, right? And there was also this sense that institutions, you know, however flawed they might be, they were basically moving in, I guess, like a recognizable direction, and that the arc of things bent somewhere actually useful. So I grew up with that assumption in the back, you know, kind of in the background. And it wasn't so much a belief. It was more like just in the background, like it was just the wallpaper. I didn't really think about it. I mean, nobody really thought about it. It was just there. It was just, I mean, for me, this was during the, I'm a Gen X, so this was during the 80s mostly, and part of the 90s, I guess. And that's really the last time that I can honestly remember experiencing any sort of optimism about the future. And I think what happened, it gradually, but then suddenly at some point, I guess in the way that most things happen, is that the wallpaper came down for some reason. And what's underneath, well, I wouldn't say it was, I wouldn't call it despair exactly. It's more like a kind of unsettled exposure. There's this feeling of being exposed somehow. So the thing that was, I guess, quietly doing the structural work, whatever that was, that it disappeared. And now people are standing in the room and they're noticing the walls for the first time. And that's pretty unsettling. So Zygmunt Bauman wrote about this, and I've mentioned him a few times before, and he had a name for this called, he called it liquid modernity. And this is the idea that the solid structures that people used to organize their lives around, things like stable careers and, you know, the stable institutions. And I guess you could say the predictable social contracts and such, you know, these things have dissolved into something much more fluid now. And therefore much harder to stand upon. And the thing about fluid, of course, is that you can't build on it, right? So, I mean, you can navigate it, maybe, and try to adapt to it. But the felt sense of being able to, I guess, plant something and watch it actually grow over time, that's a very different experience. And I think a lot of people have just lost access to that. So my question is whether this is just a mood that cycles out, you know, if you wait it out long enough, I guess. The more I think about this, the more I feel like that's not, something is telling me that that's not it. Because I think it's structural. The writer Nassim Taleb explored this idea where we've built systems now of such interconnected complexity that uncertainty, it isn't, it's not an occasional disruption anymore. Uncertainty is now, it's just the baseline condition that we're in. It's the default setting. And I think the reason that that matters is that human psychology wasn't really designed to function very well under permanent uncertainty. I mean, you got to have some degree of stability and right in life, right? We can handle a crisis. I mean, we're actually pretty good at crisis because it focuses things. It clarifies priorities. And I think what crisis does is it gives people something to push against. What's harder, though, is the chronic low-level instability that just never resolves. That just continues on and on and on until it's just kind of settled into a bedrock of chronic anxiety at this point. And I think this is where a lot of people are living now. They're living with this bedrock of anxiety and instability. And the thing is, though, it's not a visible crisis exactly. It's more accurately in the exhausting space just before one, indefinitely. So Taleb had this distinction between what he called fragile systems and anti-fragile ones. So fragile systems, they, of course, break under pressure. Anti-fragile systems actually get stronger under these conditions. And so his argument was that we've built most of our major institutions, whether, you know, they're financial or political or social, we've built them to be, they were built for efficiency more than to be resilient. And that works fine until it doesn't. And when it doesn't, well, then it tends to not work spectacularly. And I think people feel that intuitively, even if they couldn't name Taliban, you know, Taliban, explain his concept. There's this background sense that the infrastructure of daily life is more precarious than it's supposed to be. More precarious than it was advertised as being, I guess. So we built these extremely complicated systems, and then we seem inexplicably, genuinely surprised when they start behaving extremely complicated. So, all right, so there is another layer of this that I think I need to mention or talk about, because it's not just external instability that's, you know, wearing people down. There's definitely something internal happening as well. And I think Richard Sennett got at this in a way that still feels accurate. So the core of what he was saying was that the shift toward short-term, flexible, project-based work has discreetly done something pretty damaging to how people experience their own lives now. Because when you can't build a long-term narrative around your work, when you know when the job ends or the company restructures or whatever, you have to start over. Well, then the truth is that you actually lose something more than just your job. What you lose in addition to your job is the sense that your life is accumulating towards something, and that, you know, the effort that you put in and it's the effort that you put in trying to connect to something later on is pointless. It's gone. And I think, you know, what happens is the loss of this, it's certainly more psychologically significant than it gets credit for or that we hear about. Because humans, you know, we're not only motivated by money and or security, believe it or not. We're also motivated by the sense that our efforts actually mean something over time. That there's like a thread that's running through the choices that we make. And when the structure of work keeps interrupting that thread, I think what happens is that the story becomes harder to tell, even to yourself. And what fills that gap is, well, I guess, well, what fills that gap a lot of the time is, you know, there's this pressure to be constantly improving, right? Becoming a better version of yourself as a kind of, I guess, substitute for the progress that you're not experiencing structurally. And that is exhausting because the project never ends, right? I mean, there's no point at which you have arrived, finally. You're just permanently in process. You got to admit, I think there's something pretty absurd about a generation that was told to follow their passion and just, in a sense, kind of ended up in a subscription model for their own identity. Yeah. So there is this concept that the psychologist Donald Winnicott wrote about, the false self. And so the basic idea is that people develop like a performed version of themselves that functions socially, while the actual self retreats somewhere less visible. And he framed this as a kind of protection, where the false self is taking the hits so that the real one doesn't have to. And something about that lands differently when you look at where we are right now, because I don't think most people are pretending to be fine because they're just lying. I mean, I think they're performing stability because instability feels socially unsafe to admit, right? We don't want to be vulnerable. And there's no, we just don't seem to have a container for it. There's no socially acceptable way. I truly don't know if things, there's no way really to say that, admit that I truly don't know if things are going to be okay. So you perform this, I guess, functionality, and everyone around you is performing it too. And the collective illusion of functioning becomes like its own reality that nobody wants to be the first to puncture. And then there's the information piece. I apologize if I say this guy's name, last name incorrectly, but I think it's John Vervaeke or Vervaeke, not sure. Anyway, he wrote about this, and it's the concept that meaning depends on felt relevance. So that this is, you know, we need to be able to feel what matters, not just know it in an abstract sense. And, you know, when you're absorbing a continuous feed of crisis, your capacity to feel what's actually relevant is, obviously, it's going to get overwhelmed eventually. Everything feels urgent. And when everything feels urgent, nothing feels real in a way that would make you want to invest in it emotionally. And that includes the future. I think that's the part, that's part of what happened. The future didn't disappear. It just got buried under so much noise that people stopped being able to feel it as something worth moving toward. All right. So, given everything that we've been talking about, I think the escapism, that's happening, it makes perfect sense. And I don't mean that as a criticism. All right, Rollo May wrote about anxiety as something that happens when the foundations of meaning in your life, they're feeling threatened, right? And so his point was that avoidance behaviors, they're not a weakness or, I guess, a laziness. It's the nervous system just trying to regulate something that it can't resolve directly. And I think that's what a lot of the scrolling and the binging and just the general checked outness actually is. It's not necessarily apathy. It's not moral failure. I think what it boils down to is it's just a nervous system doing what nervous systems do when the situation exceeds their capacity to process it cleanly. The problem is that the regulation strategies on offer, those are mostly designed to just keep you consuming rather than recovering. So you scroll to feel better, and then the scroll makes you feel worse, of course. And so then you scroll some more to recover from the scrolling, which is, I think, this whole process is one of the more manipulative and insidious traps that's ever been designed entirely by accident, supposedly. But the thing is, how much can you really blame people for disappearing into their phones or their screens when the alternative is sitting alone with everything that we've just been talking about? All right, so I don't really have a solution to any of this. I want to be upfront about that. But I do think that there's something in the way that we're relating to the future that I think it might be worth, at least adjusting. And not in a motivational speaker kind of way either. So what if we just got more honest about what's actually available to us right now? Simone Weil wrote about attention as a form of presence. So this is the idea that showing up fully to whatever's actually in front of you, not the future version of your life that you think is going to happen, just this right now, that's where meaning actually lives, if it lives anywhere. And personally, I find that to be kind of useful in a practical sense, I guess. Because the future that used to feel solid, like the 30-year arc with the alleged guaranteed trajectory and all that's probably not coming back. at least not in any form that we are accustomed to anyway. And waiting for it to return before investing emotionally in anything. I don't know. To me, that seems like a significant waste of whatever time is actually available. And this might mean things like smaller time horizons and just focusing on local meaning instead of global certainty. Maybe it's just something simple like a conversation that actually goes somewhere for once. Or it could just be a thing you made with your hands. You know, whatever that is. Or maybe it's just like an hour that didn't involve it performing something or anything for anyone. And, you know, maybe people didn't stop believing in the future because they became cynical. Maybe they just became more honest about how unstable they always sensed that the future was. Because it's never been, there's never been a guarantee, right? And I guess the goal now, it isn't to believe that it'll get better. Maybe it's just to try to stay in touch with our humanity as much as we can while we, I guess, try to figure it all out one way or the other. And that's all I got on that subject for right now. As I always say, thanks for listening.